This is Jay Horowitz, latest edition of Amazing Conversations with Hall of Famer-to-be Gary Cohn. Mr. Cohn, growing up in Queens, Columbia University, do you ever think, big Mets, you, June 3rd, you're going to be inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame?
Jay, I couldn't even conceive of being in this job when I was a kid. Yeah. You know, my dream was to be the shortstop for the Mets, like my hero Bud Harrelson, right. But, you know, that didn't work out because I had no talent. Right. You know, and I grew up listening to, you know, to Marv Albert and to Lindsey Ralph and Bob and all the great sportscasters of the 60s and 70s. But the thought of actually doing this job was way beyond my comprehension. And here we are 35 years later, the concept of going into the Mets Hall of Fame, you know, an exclusive club that has just a few dozen members, who could have even dreamt of that? And it's still a little incomprehensible.
It'd be a weird day for you. Usually when you have the events, you're telling, narrating the scene, but you're going to be sitting with your hands at your desk with Howie, Al, and Hojo. You'll have a speech, but it's going to be a little different that you're not going to be, you're going to be rocking what people say, and it's really out of your hands what goes on that day.
Yeah, it's, you know, usually I'm narrating the events on the field.
Right.
Now I'm going to be standing in that hallowed space and, you know, I can't even imagine what it's going to be like until I walk up to that podium
right.
and start talking. It's the whole thing is just so so remarkable. I mean, you're going to be honored that day
yes,
too,
yeah.
And I'm looking forward to that because it's so well deserved.
Well,
and
you guys are friends. I'm glad I'm going to be with you at the same time. Did you have a choice of being a Yankee or Met fan? I was always a Met fan growing up.
Well, my father was a Yankee fan, and my cousin, who was a big baseball fan, was also a Yankee fan. And so the first few games that I went to were Yankees games. My first ever game was the first Mickey Mantle Day in 1965 in September. And then the next year, my dad took me to a Yankees-Kansas City Athletics doubleheader.
Wow.
And we had great seats. In fact, the Yankees, I think, lost both games. That was the year they finished last,
right.
66. And Rolly Sheldon pitched the first game for Kansas City. And it was different in those days. He actually was in his street clothes, sat in the row behind us for the second game.
Really?
That's
crazy.
Yeah, so he got his autograph. So, but a lot of folks in our neighborhood were into the Mets, and so it was a dad, one of my friends, who had a station wagon, and a couple of times a summer he would pile us all into the back of the station wagon and take us to Shea, and it was just so much more of a fun atmosphere, and that's kind of what got me into being a Mets fan.
What was your first Mets game, Karen?
I don't know exactly. It was either in, I think it was probably in 66, but, you know, I'd followed the team. I'd followed both teams, and but it was really the experience of being at Shea that got me, you know, just the grandeur of the stadium and the sound of the organ. And, you know, you sat in the upper deck at Shea, you felt like you were sitting on a big throne. It was just the coolest thing to be a part of, and that's really what got me into it.
How close did you follow it? You were 11 and 69, right?
11 and 69.
And how close did you follow the team?
Oh, by then, incredibly
close.
You
were fully converted?
It was no conversion. It was just an adoption. The first Met hero I think I had was Dennis Riband, who
right.
just recently passed
yeah,
away.
Right.
And he was a terrific right-hand pitcher. And then when Bud Harrelson came up, he became my guy.
You've been a big supporter of the alumni program, which I do know what I like about. You get a kick out of speaking not to the All-Star, George Theodore,
right.
Skip Lockwood.
George Stone. I think what's important in terms of carrying on the legacy
right.
of the franchise, I mean, everybody knows who Daryl Strawberry is.
Right,
everybody
right.
knows who Tom Seaver and Jerry Kuzman were. But I think it's important for people who aren't old yeah. enough to remember some of the lesser players to get a sense of, especially some of the characters and the guys who were terrific in their own right,
right.
even when the team might not have been great. I always talk about Mets history as being a lot of failure punctuated by incredible
right.
achievement. Well, but within those failures, there are great individual performances. And you know, Skip Lockwood was a tremendous relief
right.
pitcher. And George Theodore was a great story and had an unusual build.
Yeah.
And George Stone had that one great year in 73. And I think all these people are important to the history of the Mets?
You know, when I became the alumni guy, I try to bring people back to the Mets family. Quick story, when Hobie Landry was the first guy picked with the Mets, I called him about 3-4 years ago, and Hobie just recently passed away too, and he said I was the first guy to call from the organization in 50 years. And that's the kind of stuff I was trying to do, you know, to bring people back into the realm of things. But when did you become like a buff with the history part of it? You know,
I think that happens over time. You know, I was a reader when I was a kid, and my parents always wanted me to read other things, but I always wanted to read sports books. So Xander Hollander used to put out a guide for baseball and would recap the last year. And I remember picking that book up when I was 7 years old, 1965, and reading all about the 64 season and, you know, things that I didn't know. And then that kind of became ingrained. And I always say on broadcasts, you use things that you learned that day, things that you saw last week, things that you remember from 10 years ago, things that you read that happened 100 years ago. It all kind of gets whipped up into a stew and comes out, hopefully, as something coherent.
I have to be 35 years with the Mets now.
Now it's more than half my life, Jim.
Yeah, me too, Gary. You surpassed, and that's 18 SNY, you, Ronnie, and Keith, surpassed Murph, Ralph, and Lindsay, you know, Willie, Mickey, and Duke Award. Did you, now you're one more year than radio.
That's bizarre to me because I was always a radio chauvinist. Right. I mean, I always said, I'm not going to TV, I'm doing radio for life, this is what I love to do, and I still love to do radio. But, you know, when SNY started, John Littner and Kurt Gatty Jr. really sold me on the idea of starting on the ground floor with something new. I already knew the topic. It was just a matter of changing the medium. And it just seemed like the right time. And, you know, the fact that I lucked into having this incredible partnership with Keith and Ron, who would have known? I mean, it didn't necessarily
have to
work. Do you
think it would blossom this way?
First of all, you have to recognize that Ronnie and I were not the first choices for these jobs, right? I mean, I was second choice, and Ronnie was probably second choice. You know, Keith had only dabbled in it before, and right. We were thrown together, and Ronnie had only 1 year of experience doing the Nationals, and right. He hadn't had much direction, and I had never done TV. And so I think, you know, we all kind of needed each other. We were all kind of starting from scratch. And I think that we've leaned on each other over the years, and I think we all make each other better. And why that works out so well, I don't know for sure.
When I spoke to Ronnie referred to you as the quarterback, that he said they would take the leads from you. And I mean, is it really just Ronnie pitching, Keith hitting, you conducting the show?
Yeah, I think it's more than that. I think, first of all, it's television, so we have a large team. You know, it takes many dozen people to put on a telecast. And our producer, Greg Picker, has been with us for all 18 of these years. And he is, first of all, he loves baseball. He knows the game. And he's very creative. And he gets bored.
Yeah.
So he pushes us in a bunch of different directions. And sometimes we follow and sometimes we don't. And our director, John DeMarsico, is very creative in his own right. He's got a cinematic touch to him, and so sometimes we'll follow his lead in terms of which pictures he shows. You know, from there, it's all a matter of, you know, sometimes we like to refer to it as free-form jazz. We don't really know what we're doing. We just all have something to offer, and if we have something to say, we say it, and if we don't have something to say, we try not to say it. I think that's the biggest thing is we try to avoid the boring cliches that people have heard a billion times on baseball broadcasts. And when the game isn't good, we sometimes delve into other areas.
Speaking of that, media guides and baseball cards.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
See, those ideas came from Greg. We never would have come up with those on our own. And we have fun with it, you know. And that's the key, is that whatever it is we're doing, whether we're talking about the game, which we take seriously, but we don't take ourselves seriously. Right. We try to have fun with whatever it is we're doing because, you know, in this business, if you're having fun, then probably the people watching are having fun.
So in addition to everything, you guys have your own bobblehead now. And you do charity work together, don't you? Tell me a little bit about the charity work.
Well, my wife has run the Pitching for a Good Cause Foundation for almost 15 years now, at least. And you know, we have T-shirts, we have events, we have giveaways. We, you know, we raise money for various charities. This last year, we contributed to Feeding America, trying to work with people who are food insufficient. And, you know, it's just it's a small slice of something we can do to give back.
I want a couple of calls. Bart's home run. This was here. I mean, is that top five, one of your top five favorites?
You know, here's the thing. I do not rate calls.
Right.
Here's the way I look at it. If you're judging the career of a musician, you don't judge him right. by one riff or one lick in one song. Right. You judge him by the whole album and by the whole compendium of albums. I'm much more concerned about the 500 hours a year than I am by the one call right. in the one spot. That having been said, there's a certain magic to baseball in that there are certain times when you know that a big moment's coming, right? Somebody's about to set a record, or it's a close game late, or a guy's got a no-hitter going. Those things all kind of take care of themselves. But what makes baseball beautiful is that things happen that you can never conceive of happening.
No one could have expected that
right.
that day.
I mean, it's kind of like... remember when Francoeur lined into the unassisted triple play to end the game?
Yes.
I mean, that's the kind of thing that comes out of absolutely nowhere and you can't possibly prepare for. And those, to me, are the best moments because whatever comes out of your mouth is just pure emotion in the moment.
Two of my favorite calls, Robin's Grand Slam single that day and Leiter's gem in the postseason. Do you remember anything about those?
Well, I remember Ventura's home run, that game. It's one of the most memorable games we've ever watched. You know, 15 innings, most of it in the rain, 6 hours long. And what I remember most of anything is my son, who was 8 years old at the time, was sitting in the back of the booth next to Chris Majkowski. And he loved baseball. And but remember, we played at 4 o'clock that day. So the game ended almost at 10 o'clock. And as soon as Ventura hit the home run and everybody's celebrating, my son burst out in tears because he was so tired and so hungry because he hadn't eaten in hours and just so emotionally spent. He's sobbing in the back of the booth as I'm calling Ventura's Grand Slam single. It was one of the most memorable moments I've ever had.
How was it to work the 2 years work with radio with Howie? Peas in a pod, both historians.
I worked 15 years with Murph,
right.
who I grew up listening to under my pillow, and I have to pinch myself every day that here I was actually sitting next to Bob Murphy and working with him. But working with Howie, it was like my brain in another person, and the conversations we had that year were just so much fun because we could finish each other's sentences, and you know, we didn't know each other growing up, but we had similar experiences as Mets fans, and you know, Howie and I have a little different sensibilities, but we work from the same knowledge base, right? So it was great. It was two of the most special years I've ever spent.
Your fascination with college basketball, you work a big, missed the hardly few games, still since 2003, basketball, St. John's, now Seton Hall. You ever think you just take it a break during the winter?
No, because I consider... college basketball on the radio, that's my vacation.
Right.
You know, it's two games a week, so it's not a lot
but
of heavy
still
lifting.
Some traveling, though,
it's
right?
2 hour games and it's so much fun. I mean, it's completely different than what we do all summer. It's not, you don't have the marathon of doing 7 games a week and traveling all the time. So that's a joy for me. I don't tell anybody, but I'd probably do it for free.
Okay. How many times have you seen Bull Durham?
How many times have I seen it?
Well, I mean, you worked with Durham Bulls.
I did. I worked there the summer before they made the movie.
Really?
So there are a bunch of players who played for the Durham Bulls that year who are actually in the movie, and a couple of sports writers who covered the Bulls the year that I was there are in the movie as well. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, you paid your dues. Spartanburg, Pawtucket, Durham, hockey games and stuff. I mean, you got to have a sense of accomplishment on June 3rd that you didn't have any silver spoons.
You know who I had? I had an angel.
Right.
You know who my angel was? Dave Rosenfield.
I remember Dave.
Dave Rosenfield was the general manager of the Tidewater Tides when they were the Mets AAA team. He was very into broadcasting, and I applied to him for jobs twice.
Right.
He never hired me.
Right.
But he twice referred me to my job in Durham. He referred me for that, right. And I got that job. And then when I went back to Dave the next year and said, okay, hire me now, because he had another opening, he said, sorry, I already filled it, but call my friend in Pawtucket. Really? And I did, and I got the job there. And I think he probably had a little bit to do with me getting the job with the Mets.
You know, remember about Dave? And we used to go down, his drawers were always filled with Twinkies. He had a drawer full of Twinkies.
He did me the greatest favor, because he was the hardest person in the world to work for. Everybody who worked for him said that. He never hired me, but he recommended me for other jobs.
When we used to go down to play games there, he used to charge us. We had to pay for the meals, mm-hmm. in the dining room and pay for tickets, too, you know?
He was a character. He certainly was.
So without mentioning, how could you without mentioning names? Do you remember your first day on the job with the Mets?
I do. My first day on the job was spring training, right. of 1989. Yes. Now, I had filled in for a game the previous year, but that was my first, right. day of actually being in the stadium as a Mets employee. And I walk into photo day.
Yes. Yes, you walk into photo day.
The famous dust-up between Hernandez and Strawberry.
You probably said, what the hell have I got myself into?
It was, you know, it was just a typical day in Mets land. It was the perfect day to start.
What were you thinking about? Your first day in a job, two of the superstars are swinging each other, and me the photo.
You know, I didn't know what to think. I was... You know, watching this team from afar for years, and that was my first day seeing them up close, and it was an interesting bunch. Yeah. I mean, but everybody welcomed me. I was very surprised when I came up and started with the Mets, how welcoming the players were, and even more so the other broadcasters around the league, the veteran guys, Vin Scully and Skip Carey and Tom and Marty Brenneman and all those guys. Were so kind to me from day one, and I always appreciated
that. As a Met fan, how was it to work with Tom Seaver?
I never worked with Seaver, but, you know, being a colleague of his was pretty awesome. I mean, just sitting on a bus and having a casual conversation with Tom Seaver was pretty awe-inspiring, and I tried not to, you know, be in awe, but it's hard not to be.
Did you have a favorite guy?
Favorite Met to watch since we started broadcasting? Well, that's a hard one. I mean, I have a lot of guys who I liked away from the field, the Tom O'Malley's, the Tim Bogars, the people like that who are just terrific people. I always liked watching Juan Lagares. Yeah. He was always a favorite
the
of
king.
Mine. He was so smooth in the outfield. He was for a couple of years there, he was as good as anybody. Ray Ordóñez was just magical to watch in the field. I'm a big fan of fielding and great plays and those are the guys who I gravitate
to. Well, Gary, thank you for your time. And it's going to be a great day. You, Howie, Hojo, and Al, Hall of Fame.
And you.
And me. Well, I mean,
Hall of Fame Achievement Award. Don't sniff at it.
How long does it take to get your speech down?
You know, I wrote it in about 10 minutes the other day, and I'm sure I'm going to amend it like 50 times between now and the day.
Can I make a suggestion?
Sure.
Today I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
Doesn't that mean that you don't stay on the earth much longer?
Okay. All the best, my friend.
Thank you, Jay.
Pleasure being working with you all these
Thank
years.
You.
Thanks, Gary.